Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. It's Friday, and it's midday.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
La-di-da, la-di-da.
He's looking at you, kid.
Let's put a smile on that face.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
It's midday at the movies. As the Oscar deadline looms, studios are releasing films as fast as anyone can watch them. Anne Hornaday writes in the Washington Post that it's also what she calls important season. From Birth of a Nation to Snowden, films are being sold as much on their social consciousness creds as their artistic bona fides. We'll talk about that and some of the movies you won't want to miss with Anne Hornaday and Jed Dietz, the director of the Maryland Film Festival. It's like fantasy camp for fans of alliteration, the midday monthly movie mayhem, coming right up after the news. Welcome to the show, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Today is Movie Day on Midday. We'll talk all things cinematic on the first Friday of the month, generally speaking, and we'll welcome your calls and comments about the good movies that you've seen lately. My guests each month are two folks who pay very close attention to the silver screen, and as we'll discuss, the screens in their living rooms and on their computers as well. Jed Dietz is the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival. Jed, good to see you.
Good to be here.
And Anne Hornaday is the film critic for the Washington Post. Good to see you as always.
Thank you, and same to you.
So, Anne, you wrote a very interesting piece yesterday, I guess, in the Post, saying that fall is the season for important movies, right? So we're in the Oscar race now. Movies, I guess, have to be in theaters and have a theatrical run for at least a week in New York and L.A., and they have to be reviewed by papers in New York and L.A. by December 31st in order to be eligible for next March's Oscars. Is that right?
That is my understanding, yes.
Okay. So there's an Oscar rush, everybody getting their movies out
before
the December 31st deadline. But you also say it's the season for important movies. So what do you mean by that?
Well, this is, it's connected to the awards rush because it pretty much is launched in August and September when we have the Venice, Telluride, and Toronto film festivals, which is when all the big fall movies generally come out and get their big splashy debuts. And generally, these are the movies that are going to be vying for Oscars because the studios sort of backload the year so that Academy members will have these movies fresh in their minds when they nominate and then eventually vote. So it creates kind of a logjam at the end of the year, which
I guess, kind of a disadvantage to a movie that was released last February.
Oh, definitely.
Because you just forget about it.
Yes, this is a continual problem that, critics sort of get upset about, and theater owners certainly do too. What we would want to see is sort of more of an evenly distributed year with quality films, the kinds of films that we associate with fall, being more evenly distributed in the spring and throughout the summer. But, there are always a few. I think this year, like Hell or High Water counts as one that I hope will be remembered at awards time, and that was kind of a summer, genre flick. But to my point about the important in Toronto this year, we did see all of these, people, and I don't want to denigrate them. I mean, these are movies that are about substantive issues, like Snowden, which is about mass surveillance, and like Denial, which is a really excellent drama about Holocaust denial. We have The Birth of a Nation opening today, which is about the uprising, the slave uprising in 1831. But the kind of mantle of capital I importance has really become kind of a marketing tool that in some cases is used to detract attention away from the fact that this isn't necessarily a great movie. These are perfectly okay movies maybe, or even good movies, but I think sometimes the importance narrative takes over the aesthetic
one. So the fact that they're on important, socially relevant topics, things that people should give serious consideration to, doesn't necessarily mean that they're important as pieces of film.
Exactly. And now we have seen, I think, there are intersections. I thought 12 Years a Slave was an important movie about an important subject that happened to be artistically incredibly ambitious and sophisticated and formally brilliant.
And Hurt Locker. And
Hurt Locker, another
one.
About
the Iraq War.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And even last year's Spotlight. And Son of Saul, the foreign language winner, completely, by my lights, created a whole new language. That would have otherwise been sort of pegged and pigeonholed as a quote unquote Holocaust film. So it's not that it can't, but there's that, and there's also, you know, movies coming down the pike that I'm sure we'll talk about in the next few months, like the musical La La Land, you know, which really isn't about any kind of pressing social issue. It just is a wonderful, beautifully made movie. And Manchester by the Sea, an absolutely devastating, beautiful drama from Kenneth Lonergan that isn't about, you know, quote unquote issues. It's just about people living their lives. And I just, you know, I would love to see those elevated as well.
Yeah. So, Jed, I mean, Anne writes, for example, that Academy members may have the impulse to vote their conscience rather than their artistic, you know, on the basis of their artistic sensibilities. You think that is the case? I mean, who wants to be, you know, against Birth of a Nation? I mean, it's a very important story, you know, whether or not it's a very important movie.
And I think the other thing that happens in the important category is that is signaled by coming out at this time of year after Venice, after Telluride, after Toronto, and to some degree the New York Film Festival, those are a little bit tagged by good curators, respected people in the as artistically important as well as socially important. So those things sort of come together at this time of year. And statistically, you can go back in Oscar with the Oscars, maybe not so much with Golden Globes and some of the other awards, of who won the big ones, you know, best director, best film, best actor, best actress in screenplay. And you track third and fourth quarter release. I mean, the correlation is pretty stunning.
Yeah.
And now, of course, it's self-fulfilling because people believe that's so important, that's when they're going to release them.
Right. So, Anne, you also write that first of all, it's pretty clear that this really is a ploy. I mean, this is a marketing ploy on behalf of the studios, that they're calling these movies socially relevant and important. And you say that it's a convenient way to guilt critics into seeing their films. Do you think that works?
I mean, well, in Toronto, yeah. I mean,
wouldn't work with you, but I mean,
oh, it works with me. I'm such a bleeding heart. Oh, I'm a terrible. I'm just such a bleeding heart. I'm just a bleeding heart. Yes, of course. You show me a puppy with big brown eyes, and you know, with the, you know, it's like that National Lampoon cover.
The gun.
They know me. They see me coming down Main Street. They come right at me. But Toronto is so huge, and there are so many movies that it is, I think, a very effective way to kind of just get attention. You know, I mean, and everybody's looking for an angle. And you know, I don't mean to accuse anybody. You know, I don't think it's necessarily cynical because I don't deny that any of these things are really important issues. It's just that I think it's incumbent upon the viewers, whether it's critics or audiences, just to kind of, you know, be aware that form is just as important as content, and just, you know, sometimes they line up and sometimes they don't.
Yeah. I mean, Jed, we've talked about this before, that they're actually releasing fewer movies now on an annual basis than they were two or three years ago even. But there's so many screens. There's multiple screens in every market. And, you know, Anne, you mentioned in this last piece that there could be up to a dozen movies on any given movie, on any given weekend, you know, at this time of year, you know. Speaking of multiplicity of screens, the Parkway Theater, which the film festival is scheduled to open in the spring and then sort of officially in the fall. What's the progress of that? How are things going? Give us an update. I'm surprised you don't have your hard hat and your boots. You're wearing your Birkenstocks. You know? You're doing public radio.
And a Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah, that's right.
I was in the building yesterday, and it's coming great. We're on schedule, on budget. It's so thrilling to be in there. We're discovering historic things inside the building that in our whole thrust, of course, is in that theater of one of three that will be in there, the 1915 Parkway. We want you to see the 100 years of movie history that it expresses and represents. And it's been so exciting through the process to find things we didn't even know were in there as we pulled down ceilings and took down walls and stuff like that.
For folks who own movie theaters, I mean, if I'm the owner of the Charles Theater or, you know, some of the smaller theaters around town or even the big theaters, Landmark down in Harbor East, do I need to worry about yet another bunch of screens showing up in Baltimore?
Well, we're way underscreened in Baltimore on sort of any measure per capita when you compare us to any town, even much smaller places than Baltimore. And what we'll be doing here is filling a gap. There were 950 films reviewed in the New York Times last year. So those are commercial releases. And about 300 play Baltimore. So there are 650 films every year that don't come to Baltimore. With the, you know, we show a lot at the festival. There are a lot of things at Sundance in Toronto that never come here. So it'll fill a real need and perform. I mean, we're not for profit, so we've got other revenue sources. We aren't driven by having to have the most commercially successful, even art house films. So it'll add a tremendous amount to the community. And I think specifically in the Station North neighborhood and the symbiosis of the Charles, which really kicked that neighborhood off when. It was expanded to five screens, and the Parkway will just have a tremendous energy. And, of course, the two film departments that have just moved in now across the street from the Parkway, the Hopkins and Mica.
So your hope is that the rising tide is going to lift all boats.
Yeah.
So that Buzzy Cusack and Kathleen Cusack, who are running the Charles Theater, who reportedly, you know, are not thrilled about the Parkway opening.
Yeah.
But maybe it's just going to make, you know, that area of town just a nexus for film lovers, and maybe they'll see an increase in business.
Yeah. I mean, I think the scary part of it would be if everybody was trying to do the same thing. And you look at the suburban ring around Baltimore and all those theaters, and actually you go out pretty wide in this region, all those theaters are really competing for these 150 to 170 titles of the studio's release. We're in a completely
right.
different part of the film.
You're going to have a different list. Yeah.
And it's a huge list. That's the important thing. It's, you know, while the studios are shrinking the releases, because of all these screens, the independent film world is just exploding.
Yeah. So, Anne, it's not just the theatrical world that's exploding. Yeah. There's all sorts of other things exploding. Netflix has signed a deal with iPIC, which I guess we don't have any iPIC theaters here in Baltimore. But what's that deal say, and what do you think the impact on the biz is going to be?
Well, my understanding is they're going to pick 10 titles. You know, Netflix has really become aggressive in the original filmmaking space, and they've worked out this deal with iPIC where the iPIC theaters will show a Netflix movie the same day that it becomes available for streaming on Netflix. And so this is completely collapsing the traditional window that's existed between usually a film will open theatrically and play for 90 days and then it'll go on to other platforms. But Netflix is really aggressively challenging that model.
That happened one other time, right? At least Beasts of No Nation?
Yeah, they opened Beasts of No Nation last year in theaters the day and date that they streamed on Netflix, yeah.
So, and Amazon also does that, right?
Amazon opens theatrically first. I don't think, I might be caught out here. I do not believe yet that they have opened day and date. I don't know that they open theatrically day and date.
But they're close. They're close.
Yeah.
So the thing is, if you're a filmmaker and Netflix comes to you and says, you know, do a movie for us, in the old days, you may be less inclined to do a movie if it's sort of quote unquote only going to be on Netflix. But now, if they know that it's going to be theatrical and on Netflix, I mean, the multiple platforms, I would imagine that Netflix, Amazon, who's ever producing this content, is going to have a better pool of filmmakers to choose from.
That is what I would assume. And Jed would probably speak to this because he's in touch with that group of filmmakers who are making, you know, these are usually indies, although not always, but they're young emerging filmmakers. And my sense is that theatrical is really important to them, you know, that they really do want to have their work seen on a big screen.
And as we understand it, the National Association of Theater Owners is against this. They're not happy with Netflix moving in with iPIC here.
Yeah, and the studios. They're both very nervous about this opening up the distribution. I mean, this, you know, together, they have had pretty much a throttle on what gets distributed as a movie, and that's just changing. Where exactly it's heading, of course, nobody knows, and that's very scary to people who are betting hundreds of millions of dollars to make a movie.
Yeah, and you review movies on Netflix and the paper, right, in the Post.
Yes, we just
and
as
others
a matter of fact,
do as well.
Absolutely, you know, the last few weeks,
whether they're in the theaters or not.
Correct, like we because What they will do, I mean, the last couple of weeks they've been playing original documentaries. And for documentaries, they need to have a one-week run in New York and L.A. to qualify for an Oscar. So they opened theatrically in New York and L.A., but they did not open theatrically in Washington. But I reviewed Amanda Knox, which is a really great documentary that's on Netflix now. And today,
she's the woman caught up in that murder
in the Italian
situation in Italy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Just a really well-made doc. And then today, Ava DuVernay, who most people know as the director of Selma, has created an absolutely galvanizing documentary about the 13th Amendment and the loophole in the 13th Amendment that that has informed race and criminal justice for the last several decades.
And we're going to talk about exactly that when we come back from a break. Ann Hornaday is a film critic for The Washington Post. Jed Dietz, the founder, director, and grand poobah of the Maryland Film Festival. You can join the conversation by giving us a buzz, 410-662-8780. You can send us an email, midday@wypr.org, or send us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around. We'll be right back. Ah, yes. Desi Arnaz, after a 3-day ether binge, went in and recorded this unbelievably tacky version of Hooray for Hollywood. I got that from Hunter S. Thompson. That's like from Fear. That's right. That's Fear and Loathing in the campaign trail, and I've never forgotten it. It's a lovely song. It's a cheesy arrangement, and we're sticking with it. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Midday Monday, we'll analyze Sunday's presidential debate with Liz Copeland of the Urban Conservative Project and Charles Robinson of Maryland Public Television. I'll also have a conversation with a really cool guy. His name is Aaron Dworkin. He's a 2005 MacArthur Genius Grant winner and the founder of the Sphinx Organization in Detroit. He has done more than anybody else in the country to increase access to careers in classical music for people of color. He's a fascinating guy, and he'll be here Midday Monday. If you've just joined us today, it's the Midday Monthly Movie Mayhem with our magnificent movie mavens and people who tire of alliterations a lot quicker than me. Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival and Ann Hornaday from the Washington Post. We will take your calls and questions and comments, 410-662-8780. You can send us a tweet @MiddayTomHall or drop us an email, midday@wypr.org. So one more thing about this distinction, which seems to really be falling apart between the theatrical screens and the home screens, Netflix and Amazon and Hulu. It comes to mind to this O.J., the series on O.J. Simpson, which aired on ESPN. I saw, I think, most of it, if not all of it. Fantastic documentary.
Incredible,
But the lines between people making movies for the movie house and for the house are diminishing quickly, aren't they, Jed?
And are false, I think. You know, there. I know the theater operators, and is about to become one. I get the worry, but I think it's the filmmakers don't feel it. As Ann said earlier, I mean, I think filmmakers love having their work seen in a communal space on the biggest screen with the best sound you can get. And with all due respect to all the new technology, that can really only happen in a movie theater. And then you're not distracted by all the stuff in your house, you know. And I think this is a great example. I mean, ESPN commissioned this film from Ezra Edelman about O.J. He's made a magnificent work about celebrity and race, this thread of this whole story, and he's done an incredible job.
Yeah, it's not just about, you know, that case. Yeah.
Exactly. And it was at Sundance. They showed the whole thing at Sundance, 7.5 hours of a series meant to be seen as a series. And I think it could play theatrically without any question in the right kind of setting with the right kind of promotion.
And it has. I mean, again, to qualify for an Oscar, mm-hmm. I think we shouldn't be surprised if it wins an Oscar. You know, it'll certainly be nominated and it might win, and then it'll qualify for an Emmy as well. So
when it plays theatrically, is it like Nicholas Nickleby where you go in at 8 o'clock in the morning and come out at 3
was.
In the
yeah,
afternoon?
Or
do they do it Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday in a theater?
Well, my thought would be you'd probably do it both. You give people options of how to stagger it. But at Sundance, it was shown the whole thing 7.5 hours with some break. And Ezra was there to do Q&A and
the Wagner of movie making.
Yeah, it's kind of like the old roadshow model, you know, especially with if the filmmaker can be there. I mean, it's bringing back some some rituals and values that cinema sort of started with.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, let's talk about this new movie you just mentioned before the break, Ava DuVernay's documentary called 13th. We got a clip. Here's a little bit from the movie.
The 13th Amendment loophole was immediately exploited.
After the Civil War, African Americans were arrested en masse. It was our nation's first prison boom.
You were basically a slave again. The 13th Amendment says that, hey, except for criminals, everybody else is free. Well, now if you're criminalized, that doesn't apply to you.
They were arrested for extremely minor crimes like loitering or vagrancy.
And they had to provide labor to rebuild the economy of the South.
So, as Ann mentioned, this movie drops today on Netflix. No place else, just Netflix. It will have a theatrical run in New York and L.A., as far
yes.
as you know.
Yeah, I think it already has.
So we heard a bunch of voices there, including Michelle Alexander, mm-hmm. the author of the critically acclaimed book, The New Jim Crow, and then this guy, Brian Stevenson. I
yes.
had him on the morning show a couple of months ago. He's a terrific guy. He's the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative. So Ann, here's one of those things. It is an important movie.
Yes, it is.
It fits
yes.
an important season.
Absolutely.
But what is it as a movie? Is it?
It's wonderful. And, you know, it's interesting because I think with documentaries, the term talking head can kind of be a pejorative, but this is one that uses these talking heads so dynamically. I mean, these people are so, they're just brilliant. And the interviews are very well filmed. They're sort of attractively staged and photographed. And then Ava has juxtaposed them with archival images and on-screen graphics and on-screen text in a way that's just very vibrant and compact. I mean, she puts forth this argument so cogently and swiftly and concisely. So it's just a very rewarding viewing experience. So yes, it is important on both levels.
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting because I can see how this important approach to marketing mm-hmm. is a ploy, and mm-hmm. you could see it as that. But on the one hand, that's true, and the other. How else would you sell this movie?
Sure,
I mean,
of course.
It is important. I mean,
and timely. I mean, I think another word for it is time. I mean, you know, and O.J. was another case in point, mm-hmm. which that had been in the works for years, but mm-hmm. it just hit and it arrived just exactly when we needed it, as does this, as will Do Not Resist, which opens next week. So
yeah.
There's no denying that these things are speaking to our times, and they are they're important on a lot of levels.
Yeah.
And getting back to this theater multiple screen thing, I mean, I think with Netflix cutting this deal with IPIC, if they had had that deal in place, I dare say 13th would have
definitely
had a bigger theatrical
run.
Oh,
absolutely. I mean, it just opened the New York Film Festival, so clearly it's being taken seriously as a film.
Right.
Yeah, and the festivals, again, it seems to me increasingly important in the marketing and in mm-hmm. the life and the arc of a movie. We have Will from Baltimore on the line, and you've got a question about festivals as well. Will, thanks for calling.
Hi, everyone. So, Jed and everybody, you know, what point am I going to be in Toronto and see a clip from a film or a that says, you know, first prize at the Maryland Film Festival. It's a really bigger picture question is thinking about how we make the Maryland Film Festival that thing that is so awesome, which it already is, but it's really, you know, leading our civic conversation about how creative our region is. You have an awesome film festival. How do we really bump it up to where it's seen in that big league, for lack of better words, of film festivals in your mind?
Yeah, good question, Will. Of course, we've talked about this. You know, Sundance has its own sort of raison d'être. You know, Cannes has its own raison d'être. Toronto and Maryland has its own raison d'être, to be sure.
Yeah, and I think the biggest ones in the marketplace right now provide marketplaces and market a structure for films being launched. And we talked about Toronto. Cannes is literally a marketplace. Not only do they show films, but there are financing meetings all organized by Cannes that go through the whole festival. Sundance doesn't do the financing side of it officially, although those meetings happen during Sundance, but are very much a part, as Birth of a Nation is about to find out, part of the launch strategy, and certainly from a career-building standpoint, hugely important. Festivals like us, and I would humbly put us in the category of Telluride, which is not a judged festival, is not a market festival. Matter of fact, they sort of push away press. They don't announce any of their program until you get to Telluride, then you find out what you're going to see that weekend. But that has a tremendous role inside the film world. And that would be closer to the kind of role I think the Maryland Film Festival is building. And Will's asking a terrific question. And I think part of the answer to that is, given our model, how do you get more profile? How do you help the community lift up with more profile and filmmakers, et cetera? And part of that answer is going to come with the Parkway. I mean, once we have another venue to add to distribution options for the filmmakers, we'll be on everybody's radar even bigger than we are now.
Jed Dietz is the director of the Maryland Film Festival, and Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post. We're here in Studio A. You are welcome to join us, 410-662-8780, to be part of the conversation here on Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Anne and Jed, let's listen to a little clip from this movie we mentioned earlier in the first segment, The Birth of a Nation, written and directed by Nate Parker, made on a shoestring budget. I understand that he shot this thing in 30 days.
Yeah, less than, I think.
Yeah, that's crazy.
After 8 years of work.
Yeah, controversial on a lot of levels. Let's listen to a little clip from the movie.
Baptizing a white man on my property. Do you know how this makes us look? This could ruin everything we worked for. Boy, you'd better say something and quick.
Take heed, therefore, unto yourselves and to all the flock over the which the Holy Ghost hath made you overseers, to feed the church of God which he has purchased with his own blood.
Exhort servants to be obedient to their own masters and to please them well in all things, not answering again.
You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men.
Powerful performances. And speaking of festivals, Jed, as I understand it, this is the biggest buy in the history of the Sundance Film Festival.
Yeah, by a lot.
So actually, Mr. Parker shows up with his film and he sold it for a chunk of change.
He did, $17.5 million of the rumors. You never know exactly.
Right.
But Fox Searchlight, a major art house distributor, bought it. I think Netflix was the other bidder, the other at the final stages, interestingly.
Yeah.
And they put, Fox Searchlight is clearly put a whole lot, you know, tens of millions into marketing on top of the purchase price.
But of course, Anne Hornaday, there's a lot of controversy, not necessarily about the movie, but about Mr. Parker himself and transgressions that he was accused of committing as a college student at the age of 19, 20-something years ago.
Yes, he was accused of sexual assault of a fellow student. He, along with another student who happens to get story credit, co-writing story credit on this film. These charges have never been secret. I mean, they've always been a part of Nate Parker's public profile, but in an effort to kind of get out ahead of this, is by a large measure, this is his highest profile project. So in order to kind of address the issue early, he proactively sought out opportunities over the summer to talk about the episode, which, you know, when he was interviewed initially, he really did not sound particularly contrite. He came across as insensitive. It came to light that the young woman in question had taken her own life. So it's really become his whole, not only the episode in and of itself, but just his attempts to grapple with it have become very controversial.
And he was acquitted, but his writing partner went to jail.
Right. He was on Good Morning America with host Robin Roberts just this Monday. Here's a little clip from that conversation.
I've talked about it, and I keep talking about it, and I keep talking about it.
Do you apologize? I guess do you apologize?
I talked about that last night. You know what I mean?
But it's a. Not everybody saw last night. This morning.
You know, I'm not going to go right back. You know,
okay.
I'm not going to, you know, and I said it last night. I was falsely accused. You know, I was proven innocent. And I'm not going to apologize, for that. You know, I feel terribly about that situation. But at some point, you know, we got to ask ourselves, like, why are we, you know, is this a film that is important to us?
Again, that word important, yeah shows up. What's it like as a movie?
Well, I think the movie is good. I wouldn't say it's great. I think it exhibits a lot of the qualities of a first-time movie. I mean, I think I just find him to be a really galvanizing performer. Mm-hmm. I've always admired him as an actor. He just knows exactly how to command a camera and screen space.
Yep.
And I think most of the other performances are really good as well. I think tone, you know, in terms of just the narrative structure, it's sort of plotting on the one hand and choppy on the other. And I think he throws in some stylistic elements that don't always harmonize. So I think, you know, he's it sort of has the flaws of a classic first film. And, you know,
But still a lot going for it, it sounds
definitely.
Like.
And I mean, yeah. This is a story that a lot of people have been waiting for a very long time to see, you know, sort of monumentalized in the form of a narrative film.
And I would say another thing about it, just the like 12 Years a Slave, it sort of pulls you, whether you know, from the white side, you don't want to because of the horror that the white world was creating in this country with slavery. And the black side, because it's uncomfortable and horrible. But like 12 Years a Slave, he pulls you into that, whether you want it or not. You're gonna get specifics about that scene. The difference is 12 Years a Slave, from a movie standpoint, 12 Years a Slave ends in triumph. He escapes, and the perseverance and wit and bravery is so clear. In this case,
Nat Turner slave revolt ends in a very different way.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And 410-662-8780 is the number to join us here on Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. And let's talk a little bit about a movie we mentioned the last time we were together on the morning show, Snowden. Mm. At that time, none of us had seen it. Mm-hmm. I still haven't seen it, but you guys have now seen it as a movie. I mean, mm-hmm. again, another important movie, you know, about mass surveillance. But as filmmaking, what do you think?
I thought it was terrific. I was really entertained by it. I saw it up at Toronto. And I think that a lot of us might have expected, you know, it's directed by Oliver Stone, so you might expect something along the more impressionistic lines of a JFK or along the more Shakespearean psychological lines of a Nixon, but it's really not. It's a very straight-ahead, sort of sober-minded, sober-voiced thriller. And a portrait, you know, the definitive film about Snowden is this documentary called Citizen Four by Laura Poitras, which I still is a magnificent film, and takes nothing away from that one, nor does that one take anything away from this one.
Well, this one sort of honors it.
It totally honors it, yeah, because it uses the filming of that as its narrative, as its framing device. But I also think it really does sort of delve into his past and his character in ways that I found really enlightening, and I didn't know from that documentary. So I feel like the two really complement each other, and Joseph Gordon-Levitt plays him, I thought, very well. So I thought it was a very engaging, engrossing movie.
And Jed, when we talked about it before, it hadn't opened yet, but when it did open, there was a streamed Q&A session.
Yeah, live.
A live Q&A mm-hmm. session with Oliver Stone, which you saw. What'd you learn from that?
Oliver Stone, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and Shailene Woodley, and added from Russia, Edward Snowden, live. So I thought it was fantastic. It was a wonderful Q&A. I really think you cannot, whatever you feel about Edward Snowden, I think as you come out of this discussion, his care and his sincerity, I think, is so different than just dumping information. And I just think this film brought an energy, and I think I totally agree with Anne. There was a part of his personal life, which is, of course, crucially important. And actually, his girlfriend went to MICA. So it has a Baltimore
connection.
Yeah.
An amorous Baltimore connection.
And there's a wonderful gesture at the end that you know, Oliver Stone, love him or hate him, he is a filmmaker. I mean, he really understands cinematic language and editing and image making. And this sequence at the end,
Me,
just embodies all of that. I don't want to give it away, but it's quite wonderful.
Well, we will talk about a few more movies when we come back after a quick break. And speaking of movies, before we take that break, here's a fun event that caught our eye. Next Saturday, not tomorrow, but a week from tomorrow, is Home Movie Day. And at 8 o'clock next Saturday night at the 2640 space in Charles Village here in Baltimore, they're going to be screening a bunch of home movies. Do you have movies of you guys, like, you know, around the Christmas tree at, you know, age 7?
Not that I'm showing anybody.
I have them, and I'm not showing them to anybody either. But, you know, I'm not going to be at the 2640 space. And by the way, it's too late to submit your movies for next weekend, but this is a worldwide event, and you can catch some movies and learn about how to care for those films that you may have lying around in some funky old formats, you know, Super 8 and all that kind of stuff. So we've got info about that on our website, wypr.org/midday. So when we come back, more on theatrical movies with Jed Dietz and Anne Hornaday, and more of your calls and comments about the good movies that you have seen and you can recommend. 410-662-8780 @MiddayTomHall is our Twitter handle, midday@wypr.org is the email address. We're glad you're with us. Stick around. And welcome back to Midday at the Movies, or the Midday Monthly Movie Mayhem, whatever you want to call it. Jed Dietz and Ann Hornaday here. Jed from the Maryland Film Festival and from the Washington Post. We'd love to have your calls and comments about any good flicks, or bad flicks for that matter, that you've seen that you want to either, you know, wave people off or bring people in. 410-662-8780, midday@wipr.org is the email address. You can send us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall. So let's talk about a couple of the movies that are in theaters now, a few that are at the Charles Theater right down the street from the international headquarters of WIPR Industries. One is, speaking of Laura Poitras, the filmmaker who made Citizen Four about Edward Snowden, there's one called Camera Person. And this is, I guess, about a cinematographer who has worked with Laura Poitras. And, of course, Laura Poitras has a long history at the Maryland Film Festival.
Yeah, she does, and Kirsten, too. Kirsten Johnson made this film, Camera Person. She's a really distinguished cinematographer, and she has shot, as you said, several films with Laura and for Laura. And this is a totally personal film about her life as an artist viewing other people, and including people she loves very much, like her mother, and the responsibility of that. It's not preachy at all. It's beautifully made. It's a sort of poem, but totally riveting and personal and unusual in as a film. Really incredible. Produced by a woman named Marilyn Ness. When we showed it at the festival, she was here, and she's actually shooting another documentary in Baltimore as we speak.
Good for her. But this Camera Person's really, I hear really good things about it.
Oh, it's just magnificent. It's an essay film. I mean, it's really, it reminded me, I'm a huge fan of an experimental filmmaker named Jem Cohen, who does these very contemplative, poetic essay films that are often sort of based on his own world travels. He just goes all over the world, and it's really about sort of place, a sense of place, a sense of dislocation, but connection. And that's the feeling I got from this beautiful kind of connected, you know, quilt that she's made of all these people and places that have affected her and left their marks on her, often involving great, great human suffering. But there's just a beauty and dignity to it that's it's deeply, deeply moving. It's just a beautiful film about art and making art and, like you said, ethics and
cool. And
just human connection.
All right, Camera Person. It opens at the Charles Theater in Baltimore today. Here's a movie that I'm very intrigued with. It's called Queen of Katwe, and I saw the trailer for it. And if the point of trailers is to, you know, seduce you to watching the movie, this one worked.
Oh,
it's about a 10-year-old girl from Uganda whose life changes dramatically after she's taught how to play chess. We have a little clip. Here's Queen of Katwe.
Joseph, why are you letting her win?
I'm not letting her.
She won your bishop.
What I'm seeing cannot be true.
Checkmate.
She won. She won.
Fiona has won.
Hey, Joseph, you are not serious. A girl has given you checkmate.
What?
A girl has given you checkmate. Oh, go for it. As the father of a daughter, I'm all over this one. Sign me up, Anne. What do you think? Queen of Katwe.
I just felt like a ton of bricks for this movie. It's a Disney movie based on an ESPN. It's sort of an ESPN Disney production. So it's in that tradition of a sports come from behind contest, classic contest movie. But what really sets this one apart, and, you know, again, I dare say it's important because it takes place in Uganda. It features completely African and actors and actors of African descent. There's not one white savior in it, which I think is often a problem with movies that have been set on that continent.
Yep.
And there, it just captures so much of the vibrancy. I mean, the main character lives in poverty. And there is, you know, she suffers, but that's not the defining parameter of her being. You know, there is joy and nurturing and vibrancy and beauty and color. And it just gets all of that. And I just think it's just been gorgeously made. Lupita Nyong'o and David Oyelowo are the two recognizable leads, and they're magnificent.
And of course, they were in 12 Years a Slave.
Exactly.
That did pretty well.
Wonderful. I did not recognize her for the first half hour. That's how extraordinary her physical performance is. I mean, she just transforms herself. And it's just a great family film. It's a wonderful, wholesome, you know, that's that kind of movie you just want to send everybody to and say, everyone will enjoy it.
Did I misspeak, or were they in Selma instead of 12 Years a Slave?
He was in Selma.
David
he,
was in Selma.
David Oyelowo.
He played King in
right.
Selma.
He played Martin Luther King, yeah. But Lupita Nyong'o, she's yeah. just...
And
right.
won her Oscar just, for, yeah. for 12
she
Years a
won
Slave.
She won an Oscar for 12 Years a Slave, yeah. So this really works, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's absolutely works. It's very, very specific to the place. And also, this is, I don't want to give anything away, but this is not like all problems are solved kind of film. And, you know, it really is about struggle and opportunity. You think of education in America and, you know, it hits all those notes. It's really an incredible. And it is, in a way, a sports film.
Yeah,
also
definitely.
Interesting.
Interesting. Yeah. Disney ESPN Sports. Do you have any idea whether it's based on a true story?
Oh, it's
it
totally
is a true
based
story.
On a true story. Yeah, yeah, it was based on
even
an ESPN
better.
Article that about yeah. the young woman. Yeah.
Just like those cats playing the piano on YouTube.
Yeah.
It has to be true. You know?
Exactly.
That's right. I'm a sucker for all that stuff. Our director, Luke Spicknell, is saying, you know, do you really watch cats on YouTube? And the answer is actually no. But I have seen a trailer for this next one, too, which looks kind of intriguing. It's called American Honey. Mm. It's kind of a road trip movie. There's a sort of bunch of misfits, runaway teenager types who are selling magazines across the country. Let's listen to a little bit of American Honey.
So tell me, what was it that you don't agree with that Jake does? The lying? He ain't lying. He's selling. That's his job. I don't get what you want. You want to make money or you don't?
I want to make money.
What?
I want to make money.
It costs me when you don't earn. Do you get that? The motel, the gas, everything, that costs me. And I can't run my business like that. So you show me you can do it or I'll leave you on the side of the road.
All right, so they're selling magazines yeah. and, you know, chaos ensues, evidently. Anne, you've seen this movie. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a fascinating film. The boss lady that you heard in that scene is Riley Keough, who happens to be Elvis Presley's granddaughter, who is a stunning and a really, really good actress. She and Shia LaBeouf, who's the guy that they're both talking about, are running these crews of young people who go around the Midwest and South selling magazine subscriptions. It's kind of, you know, it's a hustle. It's a little bit of a scam. They're just living day to day, having fun. You know, they all pile into this, you know, crowded, filthy van, and they're having the times of their lives. Most of them are independent from the first time. Most of them are escaping pretty abusive and sad domestic lives, and they form their own little clan on the road. The movie has been written and directed by Andrea Arnold, mm-hmm. who's a really terrific British filmmaker who did a movie called Fish Tank a few years ago with Michael Fassbender that was wonderful. I liked the movie. I think it's a little shapeless. It's a little formless. I think she gets very intoxicated with the movement and the romance and the kind of grimy street kid vibe of this group of characters. I would have liked a little bit more shape, and I think it smacks a little bit of cultural poverty tourism, you know, just kind of exoticizing this interesting little subculture. I felt a little uncomfortable with that, but it's a very, again, vibrant film and one of Shia LaBeouf's best performances, I will also
and
add.
And she in Fish Tank, as well as this film and all her films, actually works with a lot of people who are not actors, mm-hmm. or not professional actors, and is very much, again, about very specific places and atmosphere.
410-662-8780 is the number to join us here on Midday with Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival and Anne Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or send us a tweet at @MiddayTomHall. So, Jed, let's talk about another important movie, which is called Do Not Resist. Mm. And this is, again, a documentary, a guy named Craig Atkinson. And this is about the militarization of police forces across the country.
Yeah, also a great example of a film that has used film festivals as a way to sort of get into the marketplace and is now going into theatrical. It's an incredible piece of work, and you know, we're struggling as a culture to figure out what's happening now between our police forces and our populations. There's clearly some disconnect, and both sides, I think, are at the core trying to figure this out. And this is a great addition to that discussion, because it takes this very specific event of the last few years where huge military equipment was made available, sort of, you know, from Iraq and Afghanistan buildup. at very low prices to police departments. And again, I think that was a sincere effort, but it's changed. It's been part of the change of the whole nature between police and the communities they serve. And it's a film full of insight, and the timing couldn't be any more important.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about a couple of the movies before we run out of time. And you mentioned earlier in the show this movie called Denial. Mm-hmm. Rachel Weisz is in it, and she plays an historian who is trying to counter the Holocaust deniers, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's a really well done.
Very well done. Written by David Hare, the great British playwright. A wonderful performance by Rachel Weisz, and especially wonderful performance from Tom Wilkinson, who plays one of her British lawyers. It's an again, based on a true story, an interesting story. Well, pretty well told, I'd say.
All right, Denial, a movie that's coming soon, I think. I don't think it's quite at, or maybe it is at the Charles. I can't remember. We'll have that on our website. Have you guys seen Sully?
The movie
about the guy who landed the plane in the Hudson. Yep. You know, the great the last American hero we've landed upon. Forgive the pun. So what did you think, Jed?
I think it's a hugely great movie. I mean, beautifully made. And I think the really astonishing thing is that Sully as a character is a sort of nerdy engineer guy who his whole life has been an airplane pilot and committed to doing that just as well as he can. And this is a tribute not to heroism in the classic movie sense, you know, sabers and battles and stuff, but somebody doing something really well sometimes saves 155 people's lives. And alongside him are boat captains and other people who just saw something happening and went out to help. And it, without being sappy, it's an incredible reminder that sort of ordinary life is full of potential heroism.
All right. Sounds way better than Cats playing piano on YouTube. What do you think, Anne?
I agree. I thought it was really well made. Clint Eastwood directed this movie. It's been a huge hit, just like American Sniper was. I mean, when he's in his pocket, he's a superb craftsman. Like Jed said, it's a really well-made movie. I will say, you know, I gave it a very positive review. Of course, in the Washington Post, my local readers are the beleaguered bureaucrats of the National Transportation Safety Board who don't come across very well.
Yeah.
They take a hit, and I think rightfully so, they've taken issue with the way they're depicted. So I just wanted to say that they're a little overhyped, okay? And just bear that in mind, but go see it because it's very
entertaining. I thought they were doing their job.
They were, but they don't look sensitive about it.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, that's all we have time for today. Jed Dietz is the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival, and Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post. We've got links to the festival and Anne's movie reviews in the Post on our website, wipr.org/midday. Thanks to you both. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Midday's director and engineer is the bold and the beautiful, the young and the restless, the lovely and talented, Luke Spicknall. The show is produced by Rob Sivek, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Lunch for our guest today was provided by Tapas Teatro Cafe. They're located at 1711 North Charles Street in the Station North Arts District, right next to the historic Charles Theater, Baltimore's first tapas restaurant, providing a variety of small plates. More information at tapasteatro.com. That'll do it for us today. Coming up on Midday Monday, we'll analyze Sunday's presidential debate with Liz Copeland of the Urban Conservative Project and Charles Robinson of Maryland Public Television. A reminder that NPR will have complete coverage of the second presidential debate on Sunday night, 9 o'clock, right here on 88.1 WIPR, and that you can come to WIPR.org for real-time fact-checking. One final note about an event that I'm doing tonight with the Baltimore Choral Arts Society and our friends at the Community Concert Choir of Baltimore at 7 o'clock at the Open Church. It's on the west side just off Route 40. We're doing a free-fall Baltimore event. It's called a Community Sing. So check out the Baltimore Choral Arts website for details. We'll sing some great gospel music and we will simply share the love of making music together. No experience necessary. Just come and sing and bring a friend. We hope to see you there and we hope to see you Monday on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We appreciate your listening. Thanks very much. Have a great weekend.